Without any mental reservation.
Without any mental reservation.
Or purpose of evasion.
Or purpose of evasion.
And that I will.
I will.
Well and faithfully.
Well and faithfully.
Discharge the duties.
Discharge the duties.
Of the office.
Of the office.
Upon which I'm about to enter.
Upon which I'm about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations. Welcome to the Army. Please come forward and accept your commission.
Smelter, comments like that last might deter further recruits. Would the parents and spouses of our graduates please rise? Thank you for your support. Let's acknowledge them. I thought of entitling my charge to you, Leaving the Era of Malaise. I'll debate the title throughout the comments. In 1920, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote, speaking of the post-war generation of World War I, "My generation is disillusioned. The acceleration of life for us has been so great that into the last few years have been crowded the experiences and ideas of a normal lifetime. We have, in our unregenerate youth, learned a practicality and a cynicism that is safe only in unregenerate old age. We have been forced to become realists overnight instead of idealists, as was our birthright. We have seen man at his lowest. We have been forced to question and, in many cases, to discard the religion of our fathers. We have seen hideous peculation, greed, anger, hatred, malice, uncharitableness, unmasked and rampant and unashamed. Living in such an atmosphere, naturally we drank and were merry. We have seen the rottenness and shortcomings of governments. In short, we have seen the inherent beastliness of the human race revealed in an infernal apocalypse. Here was a generation grown up to find all gods dead, all wars fought, and faith in humankind shattered." While writing about the generation of the 1920s, much of what Scott Fitzgerald said, I think, has some applicability to the generation of today. Let me try to clarify. Since approximately 1904, American societies in general have gone through approximately six oscillations or cycles that can be essentially represented by two trends in society. First is a period that Arthur Levine calls community ascendancy. These are times when we try to approach utopia, that imagined society in which humankind's deepest yearnings, noblest dreams, and highest aspirations come to fulfillment. We find voluntary individual commitment and cooperation, congruence of individual and group interests, whereby trust and mutual responsibility replace self-serving action to the advantage of all, and attainment by the individual of what he or she deems necessary and desirable. Although no known community or society has achieved this state, there have been at least three periods in this recent history where we have progressed in this direction. The second and reverse trend that Levine describes may be called a period of individual as opposed to community ascendancy, a time when society is moving in the opposite direction from the community. Individual ties with the community are attenuated, and the individual is dominant, and there is an emphasis on meism, if you will, a present-day orientation, an acceptance of the propriety of taking, hedonism, and duty to self rather than to others. By me-ism, I mean a socially divisive and individually isolating disease. It arises when the social contract between society and its people begins to break down. In its mildest forms, it is a periodic event common to all communities. It is an attitude shared by the lonely, for it separates people. It is an extreme form. In its extreme form, it robs these people of their ability to see common problems and to work together for common solutions. The problems grow worse, people become victimized, impotence rises, apathy increases, and all in all, we have a classic prescription for the poisoning of a democratic society. These two extremes represent a continuum over which we have oscillated for the past 80 years. Societies are very much like people. They go through periods of wakeful, strenuous, and even frenetic activity, and then they must rest. A period of waking, a period of rest, waking, rest, and so the cycle continues on. In this century, war has been the dividing line, marking the end of wakefulness, a final outpouring of frenzied activity, and the beginning of rest, the onset of exhausted slumber. Periods of waking are change-oriented and reform-minded. More than this, they are times of community ascendancy. They emphasize duty to others, responsibility, and the propriety of giving. In this century, there have been three such periods. The progressive period from 1904 through essentially World War I. The Roosevelt Depression years from about 1932 through World War II. And what we have come to call the 60s from about 1957 into the Vietnam War. These periods were known by such names as Square Deal, New Freedom, New Deal, New Frontier, Great Society. Such periods tend to become times of offering a sense of movement, excitement, adventure, and perhaps even magic. Their theme is promise, and their leaders are frequently charismatic. Periods of rest have occurred after World War I, after World War II, and to some degree after the Vietnam War. These are times in which the people are tired, having given for years of themselves, finally to give their lives and those of their friends in war. It is a time to rest. People are weary, they want a break. Thoughts and actions were directed outward begin to turn inward to concerns that have been neglected, to getting one's life or one's family life in order. These are times of individual ascendancy as opposed to community ascendancy. They tend to be more present-oriented, more hedonistic, as I said, more hedonistic than ascetic, more concerned with the rights and responsibilities of themselves, more interested in duty to oneself, and more dedicated to the propriety of taking rather than giving. In such eras, national governments tend to be less colorful. With the exception of the Harding administration and its return to normalcy, such periods have generally been known by a president's name rather than by a slogan of one type or another. Universities, like all other social institutions, and students, like the rest of the population, follow these same cycles. General student character varies from periods of community ascendancy to periods of individual ascendancy. And today's students, you, I'm afraid, exhibit the characteristics of the latter. During periods of individual ascendancy, students are observed to be less activist than in periods of community ascendancy. If you were to plot a graph of student activism and overlay it with the periods of history that I have mentioned, you would find that the curves and the slopes are essentially parallel. During periods of individual ascendancy, student politics are generally more centrist or middle of the road. ideological and political interest is relatively low. The proportion of undergraduates who are politically far right or far left or adherents of any particular ideology tends to decrease. During periods of individual ascendancy, students are more socially oriented than they are serious. During periods of individual ascendancy, students' social attitudes tend to be more liberal, but their politics more conservative, allowing for increased personal freedom. The 1920s were, for instance, the ages when women smoking increased sexual freedom, and Freud were very popular. The 40s were a time when students, particularly returning veterans, fought strenuously against hazing, rules of in loco parentis doctrine, etc. And the 70s were a period in which concern for individual freedom was perhaps the hallmark of the era. And also during periods of individual ascendancy, students are more likely to be involved in religious activities, and campuses are more prone to experience religious revivals. During periods of individual ascendancy, students tend to be less intellectual or academically oriented. They are less desirous of instruction that treats the burning social concerns and issues of the day, in contrast to periods of community ascendancy. And finally, during periods of individual ascendancy, students are more committed to the material aspects of the great American dream, and they believe strongly in their likelihood of achieving it. In these respects, one might say that the current college and university generation perhaps best approximates the generation immediately following World Wars I and II, rather than the counterparts of the 1960s. The undergraduates of the 60s similarly had a much greater resemblance to their predecessors of the Progressive Era and the New Deal of Roosevelt. This is not to say that these two trios of college generations are exactly alike. I don't mean to leave you with that impression, but rather that they share certain broad commonalities that distinguish them from the intervening generations. College generations also share the qualities of uniqueness. That is, every generation is different from every other generation and from generations yet to come. In many respects, the present, as I said, is reminiscent of that period immediately after World War I. That war was finally an unpopular one. What began idealistically as a war to end all wars became ultimately a bloody bloodbath, and there was no eternal peace that followed it. There are parallels between the divisions and the despairs brought about by the First World War and the consequences of the Vietnam conflict. At the end of each war, the nation suffered rising unemployment and related economic woes. Soon after came White House scandals involving the abuse of power by the executive branch. In the 1920s, this was, of course, the Teapot Dome scandal, and in the 1970s, as we are all well aware, the Watergate. This is where the similarity between the post-World War I generation and this generation ends, however. An economic upturn quickly followed World War I, and the 20s were hailed as the greatest period of economic prosperity in America until, of course, the crash. In the 1970s, economic conditions grew even worse. However, by the time the Teapot Dome scandal saw the light of day, President Harding was already dead, and there was little that needed to be done. This was not the case with Watergate, and it was not so easily dismissed. The 20s brought the nation a relatively restful interregnum. So did the 50s. Both were periods of individual ascendancy. The 70s and the early 80s, however, are somewhat different. The anticipated rest has not yet come. What rest there was continually interrupted. In addition to Vietnam, Watergate, and persistent economic woes, there were energy shortages, periodic hearings and convictions of government and industrial officials on charges of bribery and criminal acts, crises in the Middle East, and a continuing perception that the nation's leaders were incapable of leading. When people are denied rest, as perhaps we have been, they become irritable, anxious, apathetic, and disoriented, and so do nations. Today, one sees these characteristics both in the country and in the university students. The post-60s college generation has endured restlessness for a longer period of time than perhaps any other group, save the Depression post-World War II cohort, and this may explain to a certain degree this continuing restlessness, the apathy that seems to be felt today. What this means for the future is somewhat uncertain, but it is possible that the current mood will persist until the nation and its students are actually able to rest and the country and its campuses will sleepily move on to the next cycle of activism and reform. For instance, current student concern with nuclear energy and the draft may either be part of a well-publicized ripple in a time of decreased student activism, or perhaps it is the beginning of a new wave of activism, such as the civil rights movement and the House Un-American activities of the 1950s. There is no historical precedent in recent times, and so we are unable to predict that yet, but it does appear that that edge has turned, and we are beginning to move from this period of individual ascendancy back toward community ascendancy. I do not draw these parallels as any indictment of you or our current society, and I too am part of this current society, for we all seem to be products of our environmental times and conditions. I draw these parallels because I fear that your education here, which on the average began in 1977, may have been too pragmatic, too lacking in philosophic bases, and perhaps lacking in the pursuit of an idealism. It is important that you recognize the times in which we live and at what point in history we seem to be. For as much as you have been students during this era of individual ascendancy, this malaise, if you will, so too will you be the industrial, scientific, commercial, and humanistic leaders of the next period of community ascendancy or activism. Whatever your work, you must recognize that the world we live in is a relatively closed system, and movement in any part of it will have a ripple effect throughout this system. We are beginning to emerge from our hedonism, our meism, and within the next decade, we must come to grips with some communal issues and problems of a global nature and global scale. Our progress in coping with these will depend in large part upon your understanding of the interactive effects of societies, your willingness to see human and social problems before they are thrust upon you, and your willingness to take the lead in forming new ideologies for the last two decades of this century. This then is my charge to you. Whatever your endeavors in life, provide us with a new hope for a more humane society, with a new means of problem resolution, and with more timely solutions to the crises that we currently face. Thank you very much.
Jason D. Keene will speak for the class of 1982.
Faculty, parents and relatives, administrators, regents, and friends of the graduates, on behalf of the class of 1982, I wish to extend our feelings that this ceremony commemorates these people as much as anyone else, for we are a living legacy to you who have given us so much. Chancellor O'Rourke, we accept the challenges you offered us on behalf of the university and the state of Alaska, and I must confess we have to plead guilty. I feel that we are equipped to provide the state with a new hope. I feel that the education we've received here at the university has been the best that this university has ever turned out. I feel we have some of the better graduates that we've seen come out of this school. We are lucky to be in this state. The recession likely will not slow us down as much as it has our counterparts across the nation. We have a better opportunity for jobs because of the state's growing appetite for educated professionals. We are comfortable with the knowledge that you have prepared us with and the ability to meet these charges. We are comfortable knowing that we can return here for assistance and receive it if we run into obstacles. To our parents and relatives, we are grateful for your support and encouragement. We will strive to meet every one of your hopes and expectations, of which our being here today is just one. We know that when we will need moral support or a guiding hand, you will always be there. And whether or not we choose the path you would have, you will accept our choice and hope for the best for us. To our friends, in whom we've placed great trust and shared good times and bad, to our friends who never let us down, we express a sincere appreciation. It is you who see us through the day-to-day triumphs and heartaches. We vow to be at your side when you have a joke to tell, a problem to share, or just need someone to talk to. We endeavor to be worthy of your trust. You can count on us as we've counted on you. It has been a difficult task that I accepted with great reluctance to speak for the class of 1982. Something that is often missed by people is that all 400 of us have made equal contributions to life here on campus. Life on campus would be a lot less fulfilling without people like Mona Esposito, who has given us much time as the Lathrop RA, Tim Burgess, who has served as the student regent, people like Steve Hensley and Greg Kinney, who provided me with help and class notes when I happened to skip out on an important lecture, Liz Dugdale, who was the vice president of the Fairbanks Assembly, and Jerry Foster, who led the petroleum engineers to honors at their convention in San Francisco, and Peter Glass, who ran the indoor concert in Wood Center when all campus day was snowed in. There have been many who served as peer advisors, SAs in the dorms, and as formal and informal tutors for other students. Last and definitely not least are those who formally or informally provided entertainment, recreation, and parties to give the tired student a chance to unwind after a paper, a test, a final, or a hard week's lectures and labs were done. For while it is the many small contributions that are taken for granted, they often add up to be greater than the many flashier contributions. Everyone here has contributed. Let not these contributions go unrecognized. In closing, I'd like to recite some contemporary poetry by songwriter Dan Fogelberg that I feel presents the spirit of graduation. It's entitled The Leader of the Band. A lonely child, alone and wild, a cabinet maker's son. His hands were meant for different work, and his heart was known to none. He left his home and went his lone and solitary way, and he gave to me a gift I know I never can repay. A quiet man of music, denied a simpler fate. He tried to be a soldier once, but his music wouldn't wait. He earned his love through discipline, a thundering velvet hand. His gentle means of sculpting souls took me years to understand. My brothers' lives were different, for they heard another call. One went to Chicago and the other to St. Paul. And I'm in Colorado when I'm not in some hotel, living out this life I've chose and gone to know so well. I thank you for the music and your stories of the road. I thank you for the freedom when it came my time to go. I thank you for the kindness and the times when you got rough. And Papa, I don't think I said I love you near enough. The leader of the band is tired, and his eyes are growing old, but his blood runs through my instrument, and his song is in my soul. My life has been a poor attempt to imitate the man. I'm just a living legacy to the leader of the band. I am a living legacy to the leader of the band. Our thanks from the class of 1982 to the leaders of all the bands we played in during our years at UAF and TVCC. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are times when a university has within its ranks persons who, upon retirement, merit special recognition for service that they have rendered. Today is one of those times. Will those persons receiving emeritus recognition today please stand? President Barton, I present these candidates to you for the conferring of the emeritus rank.
Thank you. Each of you has served the University of Alaska for at least 10 years, has reached the rank of full professor, and has been recommended by the Campus Promotion Committee, the Dean, and by your Chancellor. By virtue of the authority vested in me by the Board of Regents, I confer upon you respectively the rank of Dean of the School of Mineral Industries Emeritus and Professor of Mining Emeritus, the rank of Professor of Extension Emeritus, and the rank of Professor of Geophysics Emeritus, and the rank of Civil Engineering Emeritus, the rank of Professor of Civil Engineering Emeritus.
The full resolution for each recipient will be found printed in the official commencement program. Will the following persons please come forward? Earl H. Beislein. Axel R. Carlson. T. Neil Davis. Roberta Rice will accept the award for her late husband, Albert F. Rice. Professor Burdick, will you please escort Mrs. Rice to the stage?
In conferring honorary degrees upon the distinguished individuals, the University of Alaska is itself honored. The presence of one of our own outstanding Alaskans today makes this commencement a most memorable occasion. The complete citation accompanying the degree is printed in your commencement program. Chancellor O'Rourke, will you please present Claire Fache? A New Yorker by birth, Claire Fache accompanied her husband to Alaska with exuberance and an openness to a new lifestyle. With a love for the art in which she was trained, she pursued her career in the Alaskan frontier. She was quickly captivated by the native people of the state, and her work soon reflected a sensitivity to the native culture, lifestyle, and history. Her desire for accurate paintings led her several times to the rural areas of the state where she lived with the villagers. We confer this honor today and recognize this Alaskan artist. By virtue of the authority vested in me as President of the Board of Regents under the Constitution of the State of Alaska and upon recommendation of the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska, I confer upon you the honorary degree of Doctor of Humanities with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto. privileged to award an honorary degree to one other whose contributions to Alaska warrant special recognition. A determined and spirited woman, Emily Ivanoff Brown never forgot her roots. She was born in Unalakleet, and with the exception of the few years she attended school in Oregon and Seattle, she remained in Alaska to teach, write, and inspire people. Widowed at an early age, she raised three sons, worked and attended school over a 30-year period to earn three different degrees from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Today, we confer this honor on her posthumously and share with you our admiration of and our appreciation for this woman of courage and conviction. And I might add, it was at this ceremony 2 years ago that at the age of 76, Emily Ivanoff Brown received a bachelor's degree in Inupiat, her third degree from the university. She was an example that we are never too old to learn or to better ourselves, and through that process, surely bettering those around us, as Emily did. Let us hope her spirit, love, and determination will be with us not only today, but always. And by virtue of the authority vested in me as the President of the Board of Regents under the Constitution of the State of Alaska and upon recommendation of the Board of Regents of the University, I confer upon Emily Ivanoff Brown the honorary degree of Doctor of Humanities with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto. We are honored to have Melvin Brown with us today to receive his mother's award. Professor Kaplan, will you please escort Mr. Brown to the stage? Gentlemen, Melvin Brown would like to make a few comments at this time.
On behalf of my mother, Emily Ivanoff Brown, I'm very proud to and happy to accept this great tribute to her. I would also like to pay my tribute to her on this Mother's Day for the many things that she taught me and her great ability to teach me the heritage of living out in the country, to survive the great heritage of the Eskimo people, as I am a part of that people. And I especially remember as a small child when I first started seeing things and remembering things was being out squirrel hunting. And there before me, two brown bear not too far away, and my mother beside me, along with a few other members of the family. And yet, without any fear, along with the grandmother, they were able to chase away the bear. And she gave me some great experiences. And I'm thankful today for being able to enjoy what this great land has been able to offer, especially because of her. I could just visualize going up the river with her and seeing the fish dart right at the bow of the boat in clear crystal waters of Unalakleet River. And I remember especially going out squirrel hunting with her and waking up 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning and listening to the birds sing and seeing the sunshine shining through the white tent, a tradition I believe that everybody should enjoy at some time in their life. And I'm thankful for having a mother like Emily. I'm sure many of you here will remember her. She lived here at the university for a great number of years. And she gave of herself, just like she gave to me and my children, my wife, my two brothers, Stanley and Leonard. And I thank you, the graduating class, past graduates of this university, and I thank the regents, President Barton, and I thank many of the other people that she was with over these years for making her feel at home, because the university was just like It was a home to her. And I thank you for making her feel at home here. And I'm sure all of you will remember her in the works that she's done. Thank you very much.
Before concluding this program, may I extend a most cordial invitation to everyone present to attend the alumni reception for the graduates, which will be held in the Wood Center immediately following these exercises. Please come and join us. The 60th commencement exercises of the University of Alaska Fairbanks will close with the singing of Alaska's flag by the Choir of the North and benediction by the Reverend Gene Dementi. Following the benediction, the audience will please be seated until the recessional of faculty and graduates is completed. Please stand now for Alaska's flag.
Benediction, I would like to say a prayer for Emily and for all of us. O Lord, support us all the day long until the shadows lengthen and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed and the fever of life is over and our work is done. Then in thy mercy grant us a safe lodging and a holy rest and peace at the last. Go forth into the world in peace, be strong and of good courage, hold fast to that which is good, love and serve the Lord with gladness and singleness of heart. And may the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace this day and forevermore. Amen.
Thank you.